Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Hafizla for their discussion on spiritual bypass, making a wrong turn, and finding the way back. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome, Hafizla, my dear friend. Today, we're going to be talking about spiritual bypass. Concept that's really become important to me, and I've had many discussions with Hafizla about it, because it's something that every spiritual practitioner and every spiritual group goes through. Hopefully not purposely, but we'll talk about that. But it's something that comes with the territory. It's really important, especially in these difficult times, because it can really get us on the wrong track. And I hope that's something we can talk about in some depth. So Hafizla, in addition to being my dear friend, describes himself as someone who has walked, stumbled, crawled, and danced the way of the Sufi for his whole adult life. He was recognized, has been recognized as a healer, lineage holder, and a teacher. What's important to him, he says, is breaking the ancient teachings from the shackles of patriarchy, secrecy, and arcane symbolism, and for mystics to come down off the mountain and engage in social justice. He has a special interest in the interface between psychology and spirituality, but really is not too interested in distinctions of religion and path and theism and atheism. Before we get started on the topic, talk a little bit more about your background and how you got into this mystical path that you're on.
I grew up in a family of engineers, pretty conventional upbringing, at least on the outside. I was deeply interested in hard science and still am. Got a lot of education in that in school and was completely befuddled by just being able to relate to other human beings. Along about my second year in college, there was a young lady that I was interested in, and she saw some possibilities in me, but it was very different possibilities. And in the classic spiritual bait and switch, she said to me, "There's this encounter group happening on campus after hours, and I think you'd get a lot out of it." So I went there to follow her. And now in those days, in the early 70s, there was some kind of terrible stuff going on in the name of encounter groups. People dumping their toxicity all over each other and then sitting around in cuddle piles loving each other afterwards. But this particular facilitator was very skilled and kept the emotional hygiene very, very clean. And I realized here is a technology based in humanistic psychology and gestalt therapy and body work and a bunch of related things that might hold the key to my becoming a human. And so, in a real way. So I started seeing him twice a week privately. And even though my whole academic thing up to that point had been geared towards hard science and maybe becoming a field biologist or naturalist or something like that, I took this abrupt left turn. And since all the most amazing people that I was meeting at that point seemed to be psychotherapists, I thought, well, if I went through what they went through, then I can be awesome like them. So I took this abrupt left turn and enrolled at hippie college and spent my student loan money going to gestalt therapy and bodywork trainings and then writing it up for credit. And there's where I learned to meditate and still pretty locked into a psychodynamic view because that's what I needed and that's what was working. And So worked in the, after I graduated, I worked in the mental health system for a couple of years, and I'd been introduced to Buddhist practice while I was in school, and so I kept doing that and going to Vipassana retreats and things like that, but still seeing things from pretty much a psychodynamic perspective, with spirituality being some kind of logical extension of psychology. And I kept hearing about the Sufis, and what I heard I liked, you know, no guru worship, because I was sure as hell not going to let any teacher tell me what to do. You know, didn't have to wear white, didn't have to be celibate. That was a big plus. And I finally met the Sufis as I moved out of the tenement apartment that I'd been living in for 5 years and took a room in a house, which turned out to be right next door to the local Sufi ashram. And so I went next door one day to introduce myself and got to talking with one of the residents. And I asked him, how'd you get into this stuff? And he said, well, I started out in Gestalt and then worked in Buddhism for a while. And I said to myself, I'm not too bright, but I think the universe just told me something. So I started attending classes there and finally decided this is a good place for me to be. It's a place to start. It's a real path. Because I'd been investigating the whole spiritual supermarket in Seattle in the late 70s, and you could have gone to a class at a different center every night of the week for a month and not exhausted everything that was available. And I thought, well, okay, this is a place to start. It seemed like this very intellectual decision, like I'll give it 3 years. And about 2 years after my initiation, I was sitting in my meditation space with my prayer beads in one hand and my cup of morning thunder in the other, and doing a mantra that my initiator had given me. And suddenly I was it. And there's a lot of different ways I could talk about what actually happened there, but just suffice it to say that the veils dropped. And I became that beingness where the mantra just exists independently, self-subsisting. Coming back to my usual sense of self, the experience was as frightening as it was exalting.
How old were you at the time?
I was in my late 20s. I was probably 26 or 27.
Still really young.
Pretty young, yeah. Thought I was really hot shit up to that point.
Well, of course, but...
Yeah.
Right.
You know, youthful grandiosity. What was revealed to me in those very few moments I was in that state, and it was probably a matter of seconds rather than minutes, but I was confronted by the absolute abyss of my ignorance. And one of the things that in my need to be in control, I realized I have no control. Control is a complete illusion. And that God, for lack of a better word, is not within. That I, this very, very contingent, temporary notion of I, was really in the divine, not the other way around, and that at every moment that boundless beingness is acting upon me, us, the world, in ways that I did not understand, and it frightened me deeply that in my work as a lay therapist, I might be damaging people because I didn't understand what was really going on. And so I left the mental health system and went to work unloading boxcars and stuffing envelopes as a professional temporary. I had this wall-sized bookcase of books on psychotherapy, personality theory, blah, 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 all kinds of books on spirituality. And I took a look at that and said, this is all lies. These people have no idea what they're talking about. And so all the books went into boxes. And I said, I'm not touching this stuff until I really know what is going on here. And that was a moment.
But I take it from what you're saying that you stayed involved in the world.
I stayed involved in the world. And coming back to spiritual bypass, one of the things that had become obvious to me as a psychodynamicist up to that point, looking around me at the people in my community, and I didn't really have the language for it at the time, but I saw very clearly that people were using the spiritual teachings, that the teachings they were receiving were being recruited into their existing egoic defensive structure instead of the teachings actually rocking their world, shattering their identity to the point where it was actually freeing them. And I still see that. And I also see that that's inevitable. That's what everybody does. It's extremely rare for someone to approach the spiritual path with a completely pure intention. You know, they want to become a better person, or they want pain reduction, or. And everything that they do until they stop is geared toward becoming a better person or pain reduction or whatever it is that they think they're going to get from the spiritual path. And I have bad news, which is that the spiritual path is not going to make you a better person.
So one way of describing spiritual bypass from your experience is that it's used to continue something that your ego or the way we were raised is comfortable with, rather than facing something that needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
That's one definition. Another definition that I found in my work is that people will use spiritual experiences, not even dramatic ones like you had, but an idea of what they're supposed to be as a spiritual person, and use that as a way of avoiding facing something that needs to be faced.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was an article decades ago in Tricycle Magazine, the Buddhist magazine, that was really sad to me. I was a practicing psychiatrist, and it was divided into two. And part of the magazine described people who were depressed and were practicing Buddhism and were becoming more depressed because they couldn't understand why their meditation wasn't fixing their depression. And they refused to take medicine. And there was another group who did take medicine for their depression, felt better, and then were devastated because that meant to them that they were not a good spiritual practitioner. Another kind of spiritual bypass, I think we're really talking about the same thing, but from a different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we are. And the breakthrough that I had in that moment, and there have been several since then, and yeah, it's dramatic, and I can't say that I recommend dramatic breakthroughs because they ruin your life. Basically trashed a career and a relationship in pretty much one stroke with that, because as I tried to explain what I had experienced to my then partner, all she could hear was spiritual bypass. And when she telephoned my guide to say, I want the practice that will give me that experience, he said, it doesn't work that way. And this is not about your relationship. And there's no way that he can share that with you, because you either get it or you don't get it. And you get it when it's the time, because it's pure grace. And what she took away from that was that Sufis are against relationships. So, you know, there are just some unbridgeable gaps. And the fact that people will take a spiritual teaching and shoehorn it into their personal set of expectations, that's just how the mind works. That's how the ego works. That's what it does. And it's a survival mechanism, because the ego identifies itself as you and your body. And where it gets dicey with people who have had some degree of authentic experience, and there's a way to tell. And that's a different thing from the people that are simply trying to, as Henry was saying, actuate a concept they have of spirituality, which is a different thing. But for the people who have had some degree of authentic experience where they go, I'm not my body, they cling to that as some kind of ultimate truth. And the rub is that at some point, the universe is going to really need you to be your body, because we are in this human incarnation. We came here for a purpose. And whether we remember that purpose or not is, again, a matter of grace. And the Sufi path, as it's been transmitted to me, is about living a fully human life in and embracing the incongruity of the human condition as being hitched to this bag of squishy stuff and minerals that sort of lurches our intellect from place to place on the planet, and the deep knowledge of the soul that that's just a temporary condition and that it's not the whole truth. And so I like to look at these various distortions of spiritual teaching as being counterfeits rather than just wrong. And so the counterfeit of the truth of my being as transcendent and self-subsisting beyond time and space, that's a real thing. And the counterfeit of that, as it lives in my intellect, is all of this stuff about we're not our bodies and blah, blah, blah. And where it gets, from a teaching perspective, where it gets weird is that the teacher is navigating the student between the edges of what the teacher knows that you need at this particular moment on the path and all of the stuff that you think you need. And somewhere in there, the teacher is, you know, there's a nudge here and a little, you know, gentle shove here, and here's a reframe, and here's what's, you know, and sometimes the truth, insofar as it can be spoken, of here's what's going on, and here's what you need to do to deal with it. And fortunately, I had some very good coaching with that particular first experience. What kind of solidified me in everything I think I know is probably wrong, and these people really do know what they're doing. Okay, so I called my guide, and I said, I need to talk to you. And that's all I said to him. He said, okay, I'm around. Come over. And I walked into the room. I didn't tell him anything about what I'd experienced. And he looked at me and then did this double take and broke out into this huge smile because he saw what had happened to me. He could perceive the tracks in my being of that experience because it was a real experience. And it was still just, I was still shaken in my boots. And he proceeded to say, here's what happened and here's what you need to do. And this is not going to be smooth. It's going to be really messy because on a path of truth, everything that doesn't support truth has to go. And what you just experienced was a big one. And he was right. I didn't handle it well, because you can't. You know, there is no informed consent on this path, because you can't know. And surrendering to that and gradually settling into a fundamental trust of the process took years for me. It took a decade.
So we started this by saying that this is part of the territory. So
yeah.
It's not like having the experience of a spiritual bypass, either way we talked about it, is something that must be avoided. It's something that should not happen. Rather, it's something that is going to happen, but catching it before it really takes hold, having some guidance, at least on a mystical path like you and me, we have guides that we can turn to, and we have friends on the path, there's a better chance of catching it before it becomes part of the structure of our ego, or before we use it as a way of avoiding real life circumstances, like relationships, just because you brought that up.
Yeah.
Like you say, that's not easy, but it's really important. And I really wanted to talk about this on the podcast, because one thing to say, it comes with the territory. It's another thing to have the experience that I think you and I have had, where many spiritual groups and paths don't catch it. And in fact, either consciously, which is really bothersome to me, or inadvertently support it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an aura about, for example, with one of the ways we talked about bypass, that a spiritual person is supposed to act a certain way. And if anything else is not in line with how they are supposed to be acting, then they're just not spiritual enough and they have to do more meditation or something like that, as opposed to just being a fully human being and dealing with all of this. That in particular happens a lot in spiritual groups. You have to wear the right clothes, have the right language, walk a certain way. And that really has become disturbing to me. So talk a little bit about that. I think it sounds like you felt your guide protected you from that.
Insofar as he could. Now, there was another level where he was as completely enrolled in the bypass as any of the rest of us in those days. Mind you, this was the late 1970s, and there was still a lot of living that all of us had to do before some of these things became clearer in the way that we can now talk about them. But yeah, he did try to protect me insofar as he could, and one of the things he said was that on this path, there's room for both the formalists, you know, the people who wear the right clothes and have the right language and subscribe to the buzzwords and the packaging material, and the informalists. You know, and the formalists do the path as it's given. They play it exactly where it lays, which is, I mean, to be honest, one of the things that I realized that I had to do was let this path have its way with me, rather than continually shoehorning the teaching I was receiving into the Procrustes bed of my psychological training, which is why all those books went into boxes. And to accept the language and the formulations on their own terms and try to understand from the inside what those things were actually referring to.
So stick with that for a moment, because that's not a spiritual bypass. But when looked at from the outside, I can see
it can look like one.
It can look like one. So flesh that out a little bit more.
The purpose of the teacher, at least on a good day, in that navigation between the edges of what the teacher knows that you need and what your ego thinks it needs or what it wants, each path has its, what for lack of a better term, I'll call its mind world. Its particularized unfoldment from divine guidance. And at least in the beginning, you have to pretty much play that where it lays. Until you don't. Until you have enough authentic experience that your own inner guidance becomes clear and it becomes reliable. And the teacher will know if the teacher is being authentic. And to allow you and to encourage you to follow what is authentic for you in your unique soul unfoldment. And it's not going to look like anybody else's. And it in fact took me several more years to individuate from my teacher so that I wasn't modeling myself and my behavior and my language and my attunement on his. And I actually needed to break away for a while to find that.
One of the things, Hafizullah, that we keep on getting back to is the importance on a mystical path in general, but also in avoiding spiritual bypass, of having a guide that you can depend on. And I think you put it well. It seems like in the beginning, there tends to be a natural tendency to, you know, to imitate. I remember when I was in psychiatric training, I still laugh when I think of this. I did a summer fellowship after my first year. So I hadn't seen a patient yet. I was just in the lab. But I knew I wanted to do psychiatry. And somehow I got accepted and I was going to do some clinical work in child psychiatry. So I met with a child psychiatrist and he had me sit in the corner and he interviewed a child. We did that twice. And then he said to me, okay, your turn. So I interviewed a child and I could barely get through it without laughing. And him too, he's sitting in the corner. All of a sudden, Me from New England developed a Southern accent. I was in a Southern medical school. My mannerisms turned into his. And I just couldn't stop myself. It was just ridiculous, you know. But when I had nothing else to hold on to, at least I had that. And I had some trust in him that he wasn't going to let me get into trouble and, you know, wasn't like I was doing surgery or something. So part of a natural part of this is, yeah, there's a certain level of, you think you're getting into the path when you put on the clothes and you talk this way. Part of the reason for having a guide is someone who knows when it's the right time to help you find out what's really coming through you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not doing that, and that's what I want to get back to, you not accepting or being able to take that step, or your guide not being aware enough, or the group you're in not being aware enough that this is eventually going to be a bypass. It's a natural beginning, but it has to change. And that's a really important point. I think it's getting spoken about more and more. I would like to get your books, by the way, if they're still in a box, you can ship them to me in Rochester. I'm not so afraid of books.
But I gave them away.
Oh, Hafizul, how could you do that to me?
I'm sorry.
My partner's very happy that you gave them away. So in any case, I think it's getting talked about more in the guise of the importance of developing your own path, the importance of finding your own way, finding your own religion, spirituality being a natural part of everybody's genetic makeup. Religions are something that are put on culturally, but really this drive we have to be a full human being connected with all that is, that's a natural part of being alive. So maybe in a way, a cultural reaction to this bypass issue is the emphasis that's starting to come through on find your own voice.
The thing about that, and we've touched on this point in a couple of different ways, but I want to make it explicit. Finding your own way is the end of the path. It's not the beginning of the path, and it's not the middle of the path. And all of that packaging material stuff and emulating the teacher, that kind of thing is hardwired into our nervous system. We are being reparented by our teachers. And it's a necessary step. And it's part of what the practice works on us from the inside out, if there is an inside and an outside. And I'm not sure that there is anymore, but, you know, it's language. So it works on us from the inside out, and the externals of the path, the vehicle, work on us from the outside in and provide a context and a necessary structure for the inner reality to take root and begin that alchemical transformation of all of the various counterfeits in our personality of divine realities. So in that experience that I referred to, that whole structure collapsed for a few seconds. And the reality of reality broke through to me. It had nothing to do with the practice, really. That fundamental beingness that we really are is continually acting upon us here in the relative world, in 3D, 4D, time, space, bodies, forms. And it's what existentiates us really at every moment, at every breath, at every instant, in a completely fluid dynamic process. And it's just waiting for those moments of yes, when we're just open. And from inside of our egos, it's not possible to be open like that. That's not the fundamental structure of the ego. It can't do that. It's not made for that. But part of what the practices do is get things in a certain alignment so that pure being breaks through. And when it does that, it shatters those structures of the ego that need to be shattered. And that has to happen many times in many different sectors of the personality. These different aspects of our personality being concretizations or reifications of something that is really fundamentally alive in the beyond time, beyond space realm that is kind of breathing us and everything else into existence at every moment. And all of the structure and the language and all of the BS around the path and all the terminology and all of the behavior and all of the necessary modeling yourself after a teacher, because it's in that way that we become permeable enough to that movement of the divine into manifestation for that to really shake us up and take root, even if it's only like happened for me that first time, just a few seconds. And so I don't have a problem with that structure, with the structure of each path. It's actually very, very well designed to put us in the position, put us in the proper alignment so that these breakthroughs of reality can actually break through and carry us out of ourselves.
I think you and I agree, except I'm willing to say it's a matter of timing, and it's a matter of paths being designed to allow for that experience and knowing when it's time for that change to start to happen. But I'm not as convinced that a lot of the paths or religions that are out there now actually can do that. I want to make sure we have a chance for people to make comments or ask questions, because as you know, we had a question that came in even before the podcast.
Yeah.
For the people who were able to make the call, I want to make sure they have a chance to ask a question.
My name's Eric. I was curious on how you knew or recognized that, okay, this is the way I'm going, or the book says this, but I'm being pulled this way, or how do you recognize what's your ego talking and what actually is spiritual guidance?
Sometimes that's really hard, especially in the beginning and the middle of the path where your ego wants to be a something. I want to be a Sufi. I want to be a yogi. And that's natural to the ego because it does not know and can't know the reality. It's simply not, it's not its function. It's not its structure. Towards the end of the path, the ego becomes integrated. And all of those counterfeits that psychologists have identified as the different aspects of our personality become assimilated into and alchemically destructured by the power of the practice. But that's a very long process. And in some ways, to answer your question more directly, sometimes you can't know. You just give it your best shot. And sometimes it's successive approximation, and sometimes we're just gifted with these moments of clear sight where we go, yep, I can put that down and I don't have to pick it up again. And I've had most of those on retreat, not all of them, but I also find that retreat is a personal retreat, and long personal retreat is a really necessary part of this process, because inside of the structure of retreat is where you get a chance to forget who you are, or you forget who you've been told you are for most of your life up to that point. And most of who you've been told you are is for other people's convenience, not your own. And you begin to identify, yes, this thing, this is authentic, this is clear, this is substantial, this is real, and it's absolutely dependable. And I'm going to follow that thread regardless of where it takes me and regardless of how it disrupts my life. One of the predecessors to that particular experience was some years earlier. I'd been in this encounter group for about 3 months, and had we been diagnosing Asperger's at that time, I certainly would have gotten the label. The feedback that I was receiving about my packaging material and my behavior and my simple inability to make heart contact with other human beings was all just in my face and had been. And I kept going because I realized I need to know the truth. I don't care how much it hurts. I'll get through that. But I have to know. And so when this experience of transcendence blew me apart, I knew besides the multidimensionality and brilliant 60 million Technicolor character, it's like when these breakthroughs happen, it's more real than real. I knew that I had to follow that thread regardless of where it took me or what it was going to do to my life. Those experiences come in big ways and they come in little ways. And you're not going to do it right. You can't.
Getting back to spiritual bypass, when it's not an authentic experience, because that happens too.
Oh, that's all the time.
For having a guide. But people do the same thing, for example, that you did. That's a spiritual bypass. They think they're having an experience. I mean, I've had many people say they have an experience of, I don't know exactly what to call it, but they're blissed out. And to them, that means I'm enlightened, as opposed to I had an enlightening moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a state. But yeah. When you act on it in a certain way, then that's getting back to, that's the bypass that some people fall into. And the value of having a guide who can say, I recognize what you're going through. So you're deciding to take this move that's based on an authentic experience.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, no, I would suggest that perhaps you want to meditate a little bit more or whatever. But this also leads in, there's another question that came in I want to get to. And it's the other side of this. And I think we've touched on it. The question was, what does it look like when there's too much focus on engagement, life narratives, the pain, everyday life? The purpose of the question is, some people will try so hard to avoid a spiritual bypass, they'll actually go the other way. Not just because it's comfortable, like you were defining before, it's comfortable to be in their ego, but more like, well, I know I've listened to this podcast and I have to be worried about spiritual bypass. So I'm going to make sure I never do that. And then they just get mired in their life because they're too afraid of having that other experience. How about that? What does that look like?
That feels, when it feels heavy, when it feels dense, when it feels muddy, when it feels convoluted, when your head is racing, trying to figure out what your next move is, or figure out the nature of the conundrum, when it feels small. And the lure, as Henry just said, it also probably feels really familiar. It's like, okay, I've got the tools for this. I've gotten through this convoluted, muddy, dense, small space the whole of my life. I've got a tool set for this. It's predictable. And that's the lure. There's no unknown in that. And there's no possibility inside of that state of contraction. It's just going to be more of the same. And that's a completely different experience, both subjectively and from the perspective of the guide, even though there may be a conscious disengagement from the melodrama, there's a sense of expansion and possibility. And where it's bypass to discern the not constructive part of the bypass, how does it feel? How does it feel in the heart? How does it feel in the solar plexus? How does it feel on the surface of the skin? Is there possibility in this? Or is its product just more of itself? And it's sometimes necessary. Here's what makes, part of what makes this so difficult, is that we need those moments. It's part of the function of spiritual practice. We need those moments of vacation from myself. We actually have to, from time to time, step outside so that the wallpaper of our self-representation is not influencing us quite so much. And this strange sensation that's different for every one of us, but for which we all have the same name, myself, when that sensation becomes a little easier, a little more spacious, a little more open, having more possibility, you know, you can take a deep breath inside of it instead of just feeling completely constricted and oppressed. That's the best words I've got for it right now. I hope that works.
Thank you.
For me, spiritual experience is not something that happens in my head. It's a whole body phenomenon. Those moments of transcendence affect the way my physical body occurs to me. It's like there's more space between my molecules, and every breath moves all the way through me and into a very, very large space around where my physical body seems to be centered in space. And it has a sense of ease and of freedom and of release and my heart taking wing. And one of the wonderful and amazing things about the time that we live in right now is that all of these teachers are beginning to articulate their experience, and there's all of these books. And the problem with that, even though it's wonderful and all of these paths beginning, the teachers of different traditions getting together and jamming, is that what a teacher speaks is in a particular moment to a particular audience at that particular time. And what our personalities want to do with it is take it as truth, reify it, make it rigid, make it into a set of rules, and then we try to have the experience that conforms to the set of concepts that we pick up from books or the internet or some weekend workshop. And I wouldn't say that's a form of bypass exactly, but the avoidance of authentic experience in favor of the counterfeits and the concepts, because anything you can put into language is a concept, and it's not the thing. I mean, we all know that. The map is not the territory. But what we're actually aiming for, what the soul is trying to existentiate in us, that's harder.
I think you did define a bypass. Part of it, it's a step on the path, but when it's held onto, when it's promoted, when it's not recognized over a period of time, that turns into what we're calling a spiritual bypass. So you're getting to a really important point, which is how do you, and I think you've explained it really well. There's an authenticity that we can grow to rely on. So part of the training to avoid a spiritual bypass is to recognize over time, with practice, usually with guidance, an authentic experience. What does it feel like in my whole being?
Mm-hmm.
I can eventually depend on saying, oh, this isn't a bypass. This is real. This means something. And I'm going to listen to this, as opposed to, well, I had an enlightening moment, therefore I'm going to get a divorce and go off to the mountains and live by myself because I don't want to be in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what the bypass is. Or again, in that the Tricycle magazine I told you about, it again, I just was really struck by it. Both people were practicing Buddhist meditation. One person was having difficulty in the relationship, and the other person said, well, you just aren't doing your meditation right, otherwise you wouldn't be having this problem. Right, that's likely not to be an authentic experience, not to mention it's usually not a wise thing for a significant other to say. That's an exact, but these things are reported, you know?
Yeah.
I'm a meditator and I'm not having trouble in this relationship. So the problem is you're not doing your meditation correctly.
For all of these different counterfeits
mm-hmm.
of spiritual experience that we've inherited, especially from the early 20th century occultists, we create our own reality. I mean, I could just go through, there's like two dozen of them, but there's a kernel of truth, just the slightest nugget. And the nugget in spiritual bypass is the essence of that experience that I referred to, which is that the transcendent reality is what creates all of this and me, and including all of the nonsense in my head about this and me, is a concretization of something vast. And it's continually acting upon us here at every instant. And the reality of that transcendent experience is not a bypass, it's reality. But if I read in a book somewhere or listen to some dude on a podcast and go, yeah, there's this transcendent reality, that just becomes a concept. And trying to live from the concept without accessing the deep reality of the experience. When we act from the concept, what follows from that is another concept and a whole string of concepts that probably are not helpful. Touching into the direct experience, it's completely undetermined and it's completely fluid. And there's no thinking about what am I going to do next. That is informed in each breath, in each moment, by the whole context of that experience and the dynamic unfolding of each moment here in concrete reality. It's all of a piece. And there's no deciding and there's no planning. There's just my response being of a piece with this moment unfolding itself, as it does according to a wisdom that is absolutely, completely trustworthy.
Betty?
Thank you. You made a statement that really struck a chord with me, and it is, at some point, the universe will need you to be in your body. I relate to that and understand that from a certain perspective, and I just wonder if you could say a little more. Well,
what I actually said was, even though you are not your body, at some point, and probably many, 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 many points, the universe is going to need you to be your body. That's the vehicle by which we live this human incarnation and live the purpose that we have here, that each one of us took on voluntarily. I know that there are people who have done past life regressions and different kinds of things under hypnosis, and they believe that they were karmically compelled to come here. I think that's just more mind. One of the other key experiences that I had on retreat was making the decision to take this human incarnation. And it's like, I've got a job to do. I'm going there. I chose it, and we all chose it, because that wasn't an experience that I had. That was the reality that my personal consciousness touched into for just the briefest time to get the glimpse of the truth of how that particular cross-section of reality works. So yeah, the universe is going to need us to be our bodies and everything that that entails.
As we're coming to the end, the piece that's coming through more and more clearly to me is the struggle with spiritual bypass is really a struggle of authenticity.
Yeah.
And that involves personal. It always involves personal. But also in the choices we make, the people we're with, the paths we follow, and there's no getting around that. And what we're dealing with in terms of following a spiritual, of accessing our full spirituality, which is something we're born with, is a real authentic experience of being a full human being, being involved in life, but not being so captured by it that it rules us,
yeah.
But not being so transcendent that we're not in life, dealing with the issues of life and the way they have to be dealt with. But yeah. Finding that we can expect stumbles along the way that we've decided to call bypasses. But one of the guidelines is more and more to find some resonance, some experience that you can start to rely on that proves itself to be authentic and genuine.
And you need a teacher. You can't do this on your own.
And same thing with the teacher, that over time, that you decide in that relationship, this is an authentic relationship. We're in this together authentically, including the mistakes along the way.
Yeah, including the mistakes.
Same with, getting back to where I had interrupted you before, I'm sorry, but where we might have a bit of a disagreement, that I do think there are paths that we start to follow, but there are also paths that become inauthentic, not perhaps in their original teachings that they're trying to share, but in their ability to walk those teachings.
I agree.
Embody those teachings.
I agree.
So whether we're talking about an individual person, or we're talking about a group, or we're talking about an organization like a religion or whatever, this issue of more and more be authentic and being willing to shatter your concepts, as you were talking about, because you realize, that was the concept I had. But at this point in time, that's not authentic anymore. And that is difficult. So thank you so much, dear friend, for taking the time. And thank you, everyone who joined in.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amberlight International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Critella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate, with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.